Okay, let's do our review. You had a few questions, I think 61, 62, and 63. So let's go ahead and cover those. We'll start with first question 61. And let me ask Elvira, how about 61? The question is, why is Ephraim, which is Israel, mentioned in the judgment of Damascus? Okay, the two were joined together. Even though this is a judgment of Damascus or the country of Aram or Syria, remember the alliance they had, the northern kingdom, where Ephraim had an alliance with this northern kingdom. So this judgment, of course, will have a big impact on Ephraim, the northern kingdom. And so that's why they're joined or mentioned together. Okay, question 62. When I went back and looked at this question, sometimes I actually don't write good sentences. And I went back and I read the question, and you might have been unclear what I was trying to get to. So the question is, number 62, how is Isaiah impacted? I think I just had impact. How is Isaiah impacted by the oracle on Babylon in chapter 21? Any volunteers for that question?
But angry, bewildered, and terrified, verses 2, 3, and 4.
Okay. Exactly. So on the overhead, a lot of things that are mentioned there, and he has a lot of stuff for that. The point is that he was emotionally overcome, verses 2, 3, and 4. I have verses 3 and 4 up on the overhead. It says, for this reason, this is Isaiah talking, my loins are full of anguish. Pains have seized me like the pains of a woman in labor. I am so bewildered, I cannot hear, so terrified I cannot see. In verse 4, my mind reels. Terror overwhelms me. The twilight I long for has been turned for me into trembling. So here this very godless nation, Babylon, I mean, they were going to come and destroy the country, destroy the temple, destroy Zion. Here he has this prophecy about their judgment. And even though it's on a godless nation, their oppressors, he's emotionally overcome. We mentioned this several times, and I think a lesson here cut off the side here. He was impacted by these godless people. What about us today? Think about people that in the world today, you know, and sometimes like Iranians, you know, sometimes we might have a very good sentiment about the Iranians over, you know, because of the country and their leaders, you know. Well, look at Isaiah. He didn't have any ill will toward all people. These are people that were going to destroy their nation. And so again, we should be, each one of us should always be concerned by all people of the world and have, you know, concerned about their soul and don't have any bias or prejudice against people. We see Isaiah, which is on the other hand, he was very terrified about what's happening to these people. Okay, question 63. Who is the Valley of Vision in chapter 22:1? Cite the scripture. John Whitehead? Okay, exactly. So clearly identified the city of David, the houses of Jerusalem. I suggested, why is Isaiah calling them the Valley of Vision? Likely, you know, there were a lot of prophets there, you know, and they should, of course, have been listening to the prophets, and, of course, they were not. And so possibly that's why he calls them the Valley of Vision. Okay, last question, 64. What was Tyre in chapter 23 noted for? And why was the judgment against them? Anyone?
They were a very rich city, and their
pride. Right. Very rich city. And in particular, they were shipping. Remember all that chapter, you feel a lot of sea things. They talk about the ships and the seaports and so forth. So they're a very wealthy nation, full of commerce, and shipping was their main form of money. And wealth. Okay, that's all the questions for this evening. Let's go on to where we left off on last Wednesday night. So we're in lesson 14, page 70. So in your notebooks, lesson 14, page 70. We're in this section here talking about the Lord's judgment against certain nations. And we're wrapping this section up here. And again, this section is chapters 13 through 27. We've already talked about all these oracles. And there was actually 11 oracles against 10 nations. And we're in this last section here, 24 through 27, the last part of it. And this section here is not a judgment upon any one particular nation that's named, but a judgment in general, a world judgment. So go ahead and open your Bibles to chapter 24, and let's look at verse 1. Let's do a reading a few verses here, and we'll see that it's clearly a world judgment that the prophet is prophesying about. And in your notebook, you'll see that these next several chapters are the way we titled it here: "The Lord punishes the world for their sins and delivers the righteousness." Chapters 24 through 27. And this first section here that we're going to begin to look at, we'll see that the whole earth is laid waste because of its transgressions. So let's look at 24:1. And so in this section, we've always seen, always it's been an oracle against a certain nation. So this is a difference here. So 24:1, let's read a few verses here. It says, "Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like his mistress, the buyer like the seller, and the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor." So here we find again a charge, and you see it's against, he says, he lays the earth waste. So this is a world judgment. And as we read through here, you might say, well, maybe is this talking about the end of time? Is this the end of time judgment? And you say, well, it's not, because you see in verse 1, you know, the inhabitants are scattered. And so this is a judgment here on the world. Now you might say, well, what judgment? Where do we find in the Bible? Or is this something between, you know, where is this particular judgment? And you really can't pinpoint any particular specific instance where this is occurring, other than we've already seen all these judgments on individual nations. It's just these last several chapters are just general, just that the Lord will bring judgment on the world for its iniquities. And this has always been the case. We know that through the Old Testament. And from the New Testament, God is still active and doing the same thing today, even though we may not recognize it. We remember that famous scripture in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34. Remember that? It says, "Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is disgrace to any people." And so, you know, the message here is, you know, God is looking over the world and judging nations, and will bring them into judgment for their iniquities. Okay, let's look at verse 3. It says, "The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word." Have you noticed throughout Isaiah how many times Isaiah emphasizes that, you know, this is the word, this is the Lord speaking? Yeah, Isaiah the prophet, you know, everything he speaks is from the Lord because he's a prophet. But he emphasizes, you know, well, who's backing this promise, this prophecy? It says, "For the Lord has spoken this word." You know, and it just emphasizing that, you know, this is going to come to pass. The Lord's saying these things. So they're going to go ahead and come to pass. Let's look at verses 5 and 6. And now we'll see why. Why is the judgment on the world? Why are this devastation going to take place? So we're in 24 and verse 1. He says, "The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants." And here's the reasons why. You will see, "For they have transgressed laws," number 1. 2, "they have violated statutes." And 3, "they have broke the everlasting covenant." So we see it's because of their sins, right? So God is holding the world accountable. Now we have here, so we see that this judgment is universal in scope. Now we have this thing mentioned here at the last part of verse 5. "He broke the everlasting covenant." And you may be wondering, well, what's this? A covenant? We know what a covenant is. This is an everlasting covenant. And so let's consider what's the meaning of this everlasting covenant. Just like any term or phrase used in the Bible, we always have to interpret things contextually. And so when we have this everlasting covenant, the first thing we do is we examine, well, where does this phrase occur in the Bible? And you'll find that it's used 16 times throughout Scripture, everlasting covenant. And what you find when you start looking at each of those 16 times, contextually it means something different. And here's some examples of where we find this everlasting covenant. The first usage actually is in Genesis chapter 9, verse 16. We know about the flood, you know, the promise that God made in the rainbow. In there, and actually in 9:16, we have this phrase, the everlasting covenant. Of course, there it's talking about God's not going to destroy the world again by water, a universal flood. And so we know, well, in this case, it's not talking about that, right? I mean, this is not, you know, that was pertaining to the time back in Genesis and what happened there. And then you can go, the next occurrence is in Genesis chapter 17, verse 7, verse 13 and 19. This everlasting covenant is also being used there. And there it's being referred to the Abrahamic covenant. And this is a covenant that we're very familiar with, in 12:3 and many places there in Genesis. And that's the Abrahamic covenant. And of course, here this is a covenant to the world, you know. And so this is not the covenant that is being referred to here as we just read. And actually, the Mosaical covenant in Leviticus 24, verse 8, the everlasting covenants are there, referring again to the Mosaical covenant. So we know just through these usages what's being talked about here. This world judgment is not any one of those three. So now the question, well, what is it then? Okay. What I suspect this everlasting covenant is, it applies to all people. It's universal. It's everlasting. This is this judgment against the world for their sins. And so there is some covenant that they're under. And let me suggest here, this is a covenant that every man and woman are under. And to summarize very clearly what this covenant is, one that, you know, love God, love your neighbor. And through their sins and their iniquities, as Isaiah writes, they'll break this everlasting covenant. I have on the overhead, in Romans chapter 1, let's just read these two verses here. You don't need to turn there. I got it on the overhead. And we see here in Romans chapter 1, this applies to every man and woman. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." This is a universal thing. "Who suppress the truth and unrighteousness." And we know the truth there is who God is, that he's the creator. We see that later on in Romans chapter 1. And look at verse 19. "Because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them." So we know that all people are under this covenant, this universal covenant, love God, love man. And I believe that's what this covenant is, and in verse 5. And so they're holding, God is holding these nations, the world, accountable for doing, loving God, recognizing he's the source of a lot of these nations, the source of their power, their existence. And to love neighbor, treating neighbor, with love. And so here's this judgment because of, you know, the things these people have done. So everlasting covenant. Okay, this next section here in chapter 24, verses 7 through 24, we won't go through that. But it describes this judgment in it. Very graphically, the bitterness of this judgment, starting in verse 7 all the way through the end of the chapter, verse 23. Okay, so let's go on now to the next chapter, chapter 25. Now, hopefully you've seen, as we've studied Isaiah, I think Brother Fontenot brought this out, and I hope you've seen it. You know, all our studies we've noticed in Isaiah, there's kind of a repeated thing that Isaiah goes through. He'll go through a condemnation, either of nations or of his people. Then there'll be a judgment against them. And then there's always this hope, this salvation, this glory, the hope for deliverance. You'll find that all through that. And here you find the same thing. Chapter 24, here's this judgment of the world because of their sins. Now this next section here, starting in verses, chapter 25, are four songs that extol the triumphant Lord. And there's actually four of them. And let's look at the first one here. Let me just read in chapter 25 and verse 1. And so here you have this judgment, chapter 24, and here chapter 25, note this. It says, "O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will give thanks to thy name. For thou hast worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness." And so here we see clearly it's praise here, thanking him for his plans. And what plans? Well, he's going to go ahead and explain it. The one he just basically described here in chapter 24. It says, "For thou hast made a city into a heap. a fortified city into a ruin. A palace of strangers is a city no more. It will never be built. Therefore, strong people will glorify thee. Cities of ruthless nations will revere thee. And so it's praising God and thanking God for his judgment upon the wicked. And there's some hope here that some of these people who are being judged are going to go under this oppression and persecutions, that they will turn to them and recognize, you know, God and give him the rightful praise. So you have here this first song, but you actually, there's four of them. Let's go on now to verse 6 and 8. Now, as the pattern of Isaiah, like I just mentioned about this cycle here, when he gets to the point of salvation and deliverance, some cases it's physical, a lot of times it's messianic. We'll jump to the messianic era. And this is where he does here in this second song. Look at 25 starting in verse 6. Now when you start reading this, it's not obvious right away that this is messianic. But when you start analyzing what it's saying here, it is messianic. And this is a song here, a song of jubilation for the feast God prepares on Mount Zion. Let's note this. So we're in 25:6. It says, "For the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain." So here you're starting to see this messianic. You know, it's not just for the Jews. It's not for Jerusalem, right? It's all peoples. It's not just Jews. This is something for all peoples and on this mountain, all right? We've talked about this mountain, right? Mountain has been used in Isaiah, synonymous with Mount Zion. Remember, we went to chapter 2 when we first started our study about how all the people will stream to this mountain that will be established in the last days. You know, he's looking for the messianic era, and this is where he's you know, a song of jubilation for this time period. And as we go on, so we got this lavish banquet in the middle of verse 6, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow and refined aged wine. And on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all nations. He will swallow up death for all time. And the Lord will wipe away tears from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. So you start reading that and trying to analyze, what is this talking about? Is this historical in the Jewish history? You see it's definitely, it is messianic. And there's some good lessons that we could talk about here, but, you know, again, we have the song. Okay, now we go on now to the fourth song, or the third song. This is starting in verse 9 of chapter 25. And here this is a song of rejoicing for salvation, he assures. Note verse 9. And it will be said in that day. And we've talked about in Isaiah when we see this phrase, in that day, and we're going to see actually through this section here, in that day is going to be repeated time and time over again. And so we just read, we've understood that the previous section was messianic. It says it will be said in that day. And again, referring to the messianic age, in that day is going, he's jumping way ahead to the messianic area. He's already done that, but he's continuing that. And this is a song of rejoicing for salvation. And note that. And it'll be said in that day, behold, this is our God for whom we have waited for, that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, and Moab will be trodden down in its place, as straw is trodden down in the water of a manure pile. And so a song of salvation. And again, it's all looking forward, all messianic. And the last song in chapter 26, here we find, let's look at 26:1. Again, this phrase, look at 26:1. So in that day, okay, just a continuation. You see how all these passages are linked together by this time reference. So he says here in 26:1, see, in that day the song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. He sets up walls and ramparts for security. So this fourth song is a song of praise for the hope of deliverance. Okay? And you remember, we mentioned what Zion is. Remember, we studied Zion, right? Zion is a concept where God is with his redeemed people and he provides a peace and protection. You're talking about Zion here. You see here, and this is not talking about literal, the city. This is not a literal city. It's looking, again, to the messianic. And how do you know it's messianic? 26:1, in that day, connecting to the previous two songs. Okay? Now you say, well, it's physical because it talks about the land of Judah and the strong city. And again, it's not, these are all figurative. He's using it and looking at the spiritual part of it. And we see the security here, right? He sets up walls and ramparts for security. Remember what we said Zion is? That's where God provides peace and protection. And here what is he doing? He's setting up walls and ramparts for security. Not physical, it's spiritual. It says, open the gates and the righteous nation may enter in and one that remains faithful. And so you can go ahead and continue on. And again, a very beautiful song about praising God for his deliverance. Okay. Let's go on now to the next section here, chapter 27. Okay, let's look at 27 verse 1. And again, what do we find at the very beginning? In that day. Again, it's connecting everything like I've been mentioning. Okay, let's just read verse 1 and stop and comment. It says, in that day, the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce and great and mighty sword, even the Leviathan, the twisted serpent, and he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea. Okay? So again, we know this is not physical. Talking about this monster, it's a dinosaur, this Leviathan is talked about in Job. Again, this is not physical. You know, it's God who's slaying this thing. It's not a physical thing, but it's figurative. And the point here is just the point he's been making. This animal, the Leviathan, is what it is. It's a symbol of all the world powers against God's people. He's using a monster to describe, you know, the world and set against, you know, his people. And what's God going to do? He's going to go ahead and slay that with the serpent. And so the point through here is that, you know, God's enemies are going to be overthrown and spiritual Israel will be gathered as we go on and continue to read. So again, you find here again, this is the God's protection. He's killing his enemies. Okay, in verse 2, again it repeats, it says, in that day, a vineyard of wine, sing of it. I, the Lord, am its keeper. I watered every moment, lest anyone damage it. I guard it day and night. So here we find here this vineyard being raised. We already talked about a vineyard, right? We said that vineyard is used in Isaiah to refer to God's relationship with the nation of Israel. We talked about that. Remember, God uses that in the imagery of a husband and a wife. Well, here we have a vineyard. But this vineyard is not the nation of Israel. This is actually a new vineyard. This is talking about the Messianic area and a new vineyard. And you see who's going to be watering, who's going to be keeping it. You know, verse 3, I, the Lord, am going to keep this vineyard. It's going to be his people in the Messianic era. And as you go on and read it, you see that in verse 4, I have no wrath. Should someone give me briars and thorns in battle, then I would step on them. I will burn them completely. Again, you see here God's protection of his people and being here described as a vineyard. And it goes on to verse 5, or let him rely on my protection. Whose protection is that? Well, that's God's protection. Let him make peace with me and let me make peace. Let him make peace with me. Repeated twice. Okay, let's look at verse 6 of this chapter. It says, in the days to come, Jacob will take root. Israel will blossom and sprout, and they will fill the whole earth with fruit. Again, because we're in a messianic period here, a discussion here, and we see Jacob and Israel being referred here, this is not talking about physical Jacob and physical Israel. I think I've made the comment here that Jacob and Israel have been used many times, same words, using of different meanings. Remember we talked about in the class where Jacob and Israel was referred to the southern kingdom. In one case, was referring to the northern kingdom. And this is one of the points we made when we began this class. Isaiah will use same words, different meanings. Well, who's this Jacob and who's that Israel? Brethren, that's us today. That's the new Israel. That's the new spiritual Israel. Well, how do you know? Well, it comes back in that day. You know, you're going to have this complete protection. This is all in messianic. And so we know in the New Testament it talks about us being spiritual Israel. Well, back here in Isaiah's time, he's talking to us, Christians, and he's describing us as Jacob and Israel. And again, it's not physical; it's all spiritual. Okay, let's wrap up this section with verses 12 and 13. It says in chapter 27, verse 12, "And it will come about in that day that the Lord will start his threshing from the flowing stream of the Euphrates to the brook of Egypt, and you will be gathered up one by one, O sons of Israel. And it will come about also in that day that a great trumpet will be blown, and those who will perish in the land of Assyria and who were scattered in the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord in the holy mountain at Jerusalem." Again, all messianic, not physical Jerusalem. It's looking at spiritual Jerusalem. All talking about the new Zion. Okay, so that's the end of this section here. The Lord's judgment against certain nations, and these last four chapters talking about this general judgment. Okay, any questions or comments on this section? All right, let's move on now to the lesson for today. We're on lesson number 15 and page 72 in your notebooks. Lesson 15, page 72. So now we're changing. We've completed two major sections of Isaiah. Now we're getting into the third section. And this third section is chapters 28 through 39. And we've titled this section, "The Lord is the Only Source of Deliverance," throughout this section. And you see on the overhead here, through this section, hopefully you've done the reading and looked over the notes that we have in the notebooks. What you're going to find here in this particular section, it begins with six woes in chapters 28 through 32. And so we just finished oracles, right? We say oracles are judgments on nations where God is going to bring these nations into account for their iniquities. Well, now we're having now, instead of oracles, we're going to have woes. And, what is a woe? Well, as you read these things, and as you know by the word, a woe is a mournful-sounding word of doom, which focuses attention on impending disaster. Very similar to an oracle, but here's going to be focused on groups of people. There's woes on different groups of people, and actually, there's actually going to be some woes on nations, as we read, later on. And then this section, here, chapters 29 through, 32, where we have, those six woes are through chapter 33, and then chapters 34 and 35 kind of go together. Chapter 34 is a prophecy on Edom, and then 35 is a promise of Eden, of Zion's glory. And the last few chapters, as we've already talked about in a historical account, is a historical account about Hezekiah and the assault of Assyria on Jerusalem, chapters 36 through 39. So that's what we have in store for us in this next section. Now what you're going to find, kind of repeated pattern as we've already studied to date, what you're going to find throughout these woes, you look at the title of this section, "The Lord is the Only Source of Deliverance," but it starts out with woes. But you're going to find in all these woes, there's going to be a glimmer of hope, of salvation. And in particular, it's going to be looking at the Messiah coming, and it's going to be looking at him from the standpoint of being a king, a righteous king. You're going to see that throughout this section being repeated in these different woes. We're going to go back to the messianic area and looking at Christ as the king. Now, this particular section, you remember when we divided up chapters 1 through 39 by kings? This last section is all about written by Isaiah during the fourth king, Hezekiah. And likely a lot of these prophecies are looking at the condition of the people and the leaders, and the things that are going on during the time of Hezekiah. You know, Hezekiah was a very righteous king. But what about the people? What about the other rulers? And you can evidently, if this is true, this section is kind of written during that time, you see they had a lot of problems. There was a lot of iniquities, a lot of corruption. And Isaiah is dealing with that in this particular section by addressing these different woes. The other thing you'll see in this section here, as we look into it, there's going to be a lot of mention about Egypt. And you're going to see some woes on the people that are trying to make alliances with Egypt and relying on Egypt for help and for deliverance. You remember when we did the historical count, remember King Ahaz, he relied on Assyria, right? He was paying the king of Assyria some money for some help. Hezekiah broke off that arrangement. Hezekiah was relying on the Lord. But evidently there was still a strong drive within the people. We need help. Let's go to Egypt. And you're going to see a lot of stuff mentioned here about Egypt. This is kind of unique in Isaiah. If you go to the King's account, you go to the Chronicles account, you really will find no mention in those two accounts. Because when we did a historical background, we didn't see this reliance of the people and the leaders going back to Egypt. But evidently it was a present. And so Isaiah uniquely is addressing this problem. And the last thing before we get into the text here, what you're going to find here, the first thing that's going to start talking about is going back and talking about the northern kingdom. It's going to talk about the leaders in the northern kingdom in Ephraim. And remember when we did the historical account that Samaria, the northern kingdom, fell in 722. And that was during the fourth or fifth year of Hezekiah. So you're going to have this woe upon the northern kingdom. But shortly thereafter, that northern kingdom is going to fall. And that happens during Hezekiah's reign. Okay, so let's look, we're in chapter 28 now. And this first chapter 28 is a woe to the proud leaders of Ephraim, which is the northern kingdom, and also to the leaders in Jerusalem. And this first section here is, as I already mentioned, is going to talk about Samaria and kind of a judgment on them. So let's just read a couple of verses here to get the sense of that. So here we start, 28:1. Woe, and you're going to see this being repeated in the next several chapters. Woe to the proud crown. So talking about the proud crown, you know, that's talking to the leaders. And of course, it's identifying their type of attitude. They were full of pride. And then he goes on, he says, of the drunkards of Ephraim. So here one verse here, we find a woe. We're talking, addressing the leaders. And this is their condition of it. Not only they had pride, but we will see that they're drunkards. And they're drunkards of Ephraim. Again, we know Ephraim was a term that Isaiah used to refer to the northern kingdom. And let's read on in verse 1. And to the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley, of those who are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord has a strong and mighty agent, as a storm of hail, a tempest of destruction, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters, yet cast it down to the earth with his hand. Okay, so in verse 1, he talks about this fading flower. It says, which is at the head of the fertile valley. If you remember, and I think I gave you some verses to go back and look at, we know the capital of the northern kingdom was Samaria. When Samaria was identified to be the capital of the northern kingdom, it was actually done by Omri, the father of Ahab. He picked the city on top of a brow, so it was on a mountain, and it was a fortified city, and there was a lush valley all around that. You can see how Isaiah is describing that. He says, to the fading flower of his glorious beauty, talking about the city of Samaria, which is at the head, the capital, is at the head of this fertile valley. So you're talking here to, of course, the leaders of the country, you know, in the capital city, and of course they're proud. Proud of the city, proud of that, you know, it's fortified, it's a very rich thing. But as we just read in verse 2, what's going to happen to this fading flower? You know, it's going to wither away. And what's going to happen, again, as we've seen throughout Isaiah, the Lord's going to bring someone against them, as he describes here, a strong and mighty agent. And who is this agent? We know, we've already talked about it in chapter 8. That's Assyria. And of course, Assyria comes and wipes out this country. And so here, you know, Isaiah, we already read chapter 8. He knows that the northern kingdom is going to fall. He's still trying to plead the leaders, trying to get them to see, to change their ways. And it's just, you know, years, not too many years before it's going to fall. Cast us down to the earth. Okay. And then it says the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim is trodden underfoot, and the fading flower of its glorious beauty. So, of course, the city is going to be destroyed by Assyria. Okay, let's look at, now here, even within this section here, it's only through these first six verses here. So here we have this judgment coming upon the nation. You know, it's identified, you know, what the problem is. They're proud. They're drunk. You know, they're not evidently not changing their ways. They're going to be destroyed. But now look at verse five. Again, we find here's this judgment. What do we see in verse 5 and 6? It says, in that day, the Lord of hosts become a beautiful crown. And so here's this hope. And again, I think it's messianic here. And a glorious diadem to the remnant of his people. So even though there's going to be destroyed, you know, here's this hope of salvation and it'll going back to the Messiah. This beautiful crown, a glorious diadem to the remnant of his people. A spirit of justice for him who sits in judgment. A strength to those who repel the onslaught at the gate. A strength to those, okay, and I just read that, a strength to those who repel the onslaught at the gate. Again, here you find this hope, even being mentioned here against this, this judgment on the northern kingdom. Okay, this next section here is now, it's going to switch gears and talk about the Jerusalem rulers. And they're also scorned because of their condition, because of their arrogance, and this covenant of death that we'll read about. As we start reading verse 7, it's not obvious he's switching gears, Isaiah's switching gears and talking about another group of people, but he is. And the first indication in verse 7, and these also, you hear the word also? Who's this also being referred to? If you drop down to verse 14, you know, this whole section is about the rulers of Jerusalem. Look at verse 14. Therefore, hear the word, O Lord, O scoffers, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. So in verse 7, he switched gears. Now he's talking to the leaders in the southern kingdom. And let's look at their problem. And again, they had the same problem that the northern kingdom had. They had the strong drink. Look at verse 7. And these also reel with wine and stagger from strong drink. It says, the prophet and the priest reel with strong drink. They are confused by wine. They stagger from the strong drink. They reel while having visions. They totter when rendering judgments. So here he's definitely looking at the priest and the prophets. Now these people, these groups should have been guiding the people, warning the people, but they're also drinking. They're also involved with strong wine. How can they prophesy? And that's, he makes that point. In the last part of verse 7, it says, and they totter when rendering judgment. The American Standard, the King James, says they err in vision. No, they can't make appropriate visions and guide the people because what? They're also drunk. And so here we find this woe being now extended to the priests and prophets of the southern kingdom. Again, they should have been guiding the people, but they were not. I think I gave you some verses to read. The priests were not allowed to drink wine when they serviced. If you looked at Leviticus 10, verses 8 through 11, that shows that. I mean, they weren't even supposed to be doing this, drinking the strong drink. But here they are. And so this drunkenness, you know, I remember when I looked at the Kings and the Chronicles account, you really didn't get this message that alcohol and drinking was a big problem in the country. But Isaiah, this is not the first time that we come across that. And it definitely affected the leaders. And if this is written during Hezekiah's time, these are people that Hezekiah has to deal with and problems that he has to work with. And so, you know, he's addressing this to the people of the time that he's around. Isaiah's there, Hezekiah's there, you know, trying to, get these leaders to change their ways. Verse 8 gets very graphic. And we know Isaiah is a very graphic person, uses illustration to show the severeness of their iniquities. It says, look at verse 8. For all the tables are full of filthy vomit without a single clean place. So very graphically describing, you know, these, and who are these? That they're supposed to be the leaders. And, you know, they have problems, as we just read. Okay, 14 and 15. Let's drop down here. So we have the problem with the priests and the prophets drinking, evidently not guiding the people. And then he goes on in verses 9 through 13 to rebuke them. And some of these right in here, the people actually start rebuking Isaiah. We won't cover that here, but Isaiah is actually being rebuked here by the people, maybe these prophet and priests that he's trying to address. But look at verse 14, as we just read, and let's look at something else here they had a problem with. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, O scoffers, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by. For we have made this falsehood our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. So here we find another problem that the leaders had. You know, and basically we have this thing, this covenant of death. And what is this covenant of death? Evidently it's something they're saying that, you know, we're not going to be impacted by, you know, the surrounding events. We're going to be protected. You know, they had a self-assurance that God wasn't going to bring judgment against them. And what specifically this covenant was, we know Ahab made some covenants with the nations. Were some of the people trying to think that they still had a covenant, and whether this would be with Egypt or, you know, maybe thinking about going and making a covenant with Assyria. But the way Isaiah described it, it's a covenant with death. You know, these nations are not going to protect you. You know, it's God's going to protect you. And he talks about this covenant. It's a falsehood. You know, you don't rely on others. You know, you need to be relying, as we know, as he talked many times, you need to rely on the Lord. And of course, they were not. And so another problem, not only drunkenness, but this arrogance that the other nations could protect them. And of course, Isaiah clearly says that, no, that's not going to happen. You need to fear God.
Rocky, can I interrupt you just a moment?
Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
In your Bible, the way that it's formatted, is there a break between verse 6 and 7 of faith?
No, it's not. It continues on.
Between 8 and 9, right?
Yeah, there's right, space 8 and 9, no space between
6. It's worth noting, the way you're breaking it down, actually the space ought to be between 6 and 7 and not between 8 and 9 if your arrangement is right. And just a note to the reader, not to always depend upon the format of a particular translation when you're reading it. I didn't do it, but it'd be interesting to compare to other translations, see how they divided that.
Right. So Steve's point's a good one to make. You know, sometimes when in this poetic writing, there'll be a space. And so a certain text kind of goes with a certain theme. And you see in my Bible, like Steve mentioned, the break is between 8 and 9. But as we divided this line, we divided between 6 and 7. There is no break. So don't rely on the editors of the Bible because you have breaks. We know capitalization, punctuation, and all that. You have to read the text and see, you know, where is this the breaks. It's clearly verse 7 because he's talking now to another group of people. And so good point that Steve makes.
What's breaking this train of thought?
Between 6 and 7, right. The breaking train of thought is between 6 and 7 and not 8 and 9. And the editors of the Bible suggest there's a breaking thought between 8 and 9, and I don't think there is. That's the point. But, you know, read the text and see how you feel about that. Okay, let's go on now to the last section here. We won't cover that. In chapter 28, the last section here is a parable, and it's about a farm. Starting in verse 23 through 29 is a farm parable that teaches about, you know, God's work is carefully and purposely planned. So, you know, like we say, Isaiah uses many ways of writing and describing things to us and to the readers of that time, and uses parables and, you know, he uses many different forms of techniques to get his point across. Okay, let's go now to the next woe in chapter 29. Okay, we talked about this in a couple of classes ago about the word Area, but let's look at 29. Here this woe is against the city of Ariel, and we know that's the city of Jerusalem. And the woe is against those who hide their plans from the Lord. And this first section here, verses 1 through 8, is that Jerusalem will be afflicted, but later delivered it. So let's start in 29:1. Again, here's another woe. Okay, let's stop here. We weren't able to cover our lessons. We'll maybe do that at our next study. We're running a little bit behind, but that's not a problem. You know, we'll cover the things that we need to cover with the time that it's allowed it. So we'll pick up here on Sunday morning. So we'll probably finish this section, and if we have chance, we may start the next section. So go ahead and do lesson 16. Look it over, and hopefully everyone's been doing the reading. The lessons I've prepared here don't have a lot of work to do, and the work that you need to be doing is really doing the reading. I encourage you to continue the reading program. Okay, thank you for your good attention. We'll begin on Sunday morning.